And we are ready. I'm going to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order on this June 12th and open up an informational hearing on this triple aim hocus pocus. Is that? No. That's a different day. On innovations in pharmacy services. And, Representative Thompson is our guiding angel on this one, so he'll lead off with questions when we get started. Please introduce yourself. And
yes, hi. Thanks, Chairman Greenlick. We're really excited to come and give a little information. It's going to be pretty high level. We want to have you guys understand kind of what's happening in the clinical pharmacy services arena. My name is Corey Hewitt. I'm the director of pharmacy at Meridian Park Hospital. I'm also the chairman of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, which is a conglomerate of OSHP, which represents health systems and the hospital side, and then OSPA, the State Pharmacy Association, which is the community pharmacies. We come in and meet as a team and try to have a unified voice across the profession, and I'm the chairman of that as well.
And is it true? No, please go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Are there two arms of the retail side, one that represents the chains and one that represents the independents as well?
No, that's all. No, there isn't.
It's all in the pharmacy.
It is, OSPA, yeah.
And my name is Stacey Rimmers. I am a pharmacist. I teach at Oregon State University, and then I also practice at the community health centers of Benton and Linn County. So we're a federally qualified health care center with four locations. I'm obviously in Benton and Linn County.
I'd like to introduce a couple of the team members, if it's okay, because they've been instrumental in the work that we're doing.
Great.
Representing Acumenture Health, who is our quality improvement specialist for CMS. So,
my name is Tracy Carver, and Corey said I'm with Acumenture Health. We're working on medication safety. We started with Medicare benefits.
Are you going to be testifying? You're welcome.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Thank you. We saw that this really aligns with the larger goals of what we're trying to accomplish around medication safety.
Sitting back there, you're not on the record, so.
That's okay. If we need to be, we'll come up. So we, Acumenture Health, we're the federal contractor, the quality improvement organization, and under our current contract, we're tasked to work on medication safety in Oregon for dual eligibles, for Medicare beneficiaries, and now we're expanding to Medicaid recipients.
Okay, that's all. You want any more? Come on, you're welcome.
Good.
You're welcome to come on. Corey, you want to carry on?
Sure. So, we're ready. So kind of the topic of today is how clinical pharmacy services, and you'll hear me call it CPS as we go through this talk, how can we help achieve the triple aim? So just to frame why we're talking to you guys today. As you guys are probably aware, medication-related problems are reaching a crisis in this country, and we really believe strongly that clinical pharmacy services can help reverse that trend. In addition, we really see things across the country transforming with ACOs, but in this state, most of the talk has been around CCOs, and we're here to ensure that the clinical pharmacy services are integrated as part of a whole service to all patients across all payers, and we really want to ensure that pharmacists are working at the top of their license and using their clinical drug expertise as we move forward. So, the burden of medication-related problems. This is a study that was published in 2007 in the Institute of Medicine. And it's really a quote that says that pharmaceuticals are the most common medical intervention, and that their potential for both help and harm is enormous, and we know that. Ensuring that the American people get the most benefit from advances in pharmacology is a critical component of improving the care. We continue to see, as the population gets older, as you know, In the acute care side, it's not uncommon for a patient to come into our hospital with over 30 medications. And so when they're trying to navigate those medications, we continually see issues, and we're here to help navigate that issue, and we think we can do that. So let's talk a little bit about the cost of medication-related problems. This was a study that was published in August of 2009 by the New England Healthcare Institute, and really it highlighted a avoidable medical spending of over $290 billion a year in medication-related events. And that included untreated indications, improper drug selection, subtherapeutic dosage, and as you can see, drug interactions and drugs used without indication. In addition to that, this contributed to almost 1.1 million deaths annually. This was a study or a quote that was published by the Institute of Safe Medication Practice, and from a clinician standpoint, we use this quite a bit. But the FDA received almost 20,000 reports of patient deaths associated with drug therapy, which was a 14% increase compared to 2008. And you guys are probably aware well with the work we've done with the PDMP, with the work that's been the governor's task force around drug abuse. It's amazing to me when I sat in that meeting and drug-related deaths and opiate overdose have surpassed motor vehicle accidents, which is really incredible when you think about it. So the work that pharmacists do and physicians around the PDMP and safe medication use is very important.
Can I ask one question there?
Sure.
That was drug-related to pharmaceuticals, or does that include, you know, heroin, meth, other things?
It was just opiate-related overdoses, prescription, not
prescription.
Heroin.
Just prescription.
Yep. We pulled that out. Yep.
Wow.
And what we're seeing is, now let me think about that.
Are you talking about the one?
The one that surpassed car accidents.
Oh, that's medication-related deaths. So in Oregon, those are primarily related to
prescription
drugs. Yep.
Right. Hence the use of the PMP is very important. So some other costs related to medications, and this is comes from CMS data that really relating to the hospital setting, which is where is close to my practice setting. The Inspector General reported that medication errors are the top preventable cause of serious adverse events when patients come into the hospital, and medication errors or lack of medication reconciliation was cited as top cause of avoidable readmissions. And you know, when we talk about, in my setting, our administrators get readmissions are a hot button right now in the terminology. And we've been doing some pilots with the advent of the medical record, whereas pharmacists are reviewing medicines before patients are getting admitted, and we're catching a bunch of errors before the physicians are really seeing them and you know, continue those medicines on the inside. But really what's even more important is we're having an opportunity to interact right before the patients go home. Once the physician signs the discharge orders, we're really seeing that duplicate therapies and or a lack of omission. For example, just the other day, one patient came in with a newly diagnosed atrial fibrillation. We were dosing their warfarin. The pharmacy was on the inpatient side. That patient, upon discharge, the physician forgot to order the warfarin. Okay, and that patient would have went into the community or into this case, it was a skilled nursing facility without any anticoagulation. So very high risk for stroke. This little pilot we're doing, which started about 2 weeks ago, the pharmacist just took a really quick high look. He says, well, doc, called him up and said, doc, do you intend to continue anticoagulation? He goes, oh, of course, yes, I'm sorry that omission was. So right there was one case of a pretty important interaction that we made. So,
what does reconciliation mean in this context?
It's a great question. What we're really trying to do on a reconciliation is when a patient comes in from the community, reconciling the medicines that they're really on. It might be multiple pharmacies across multiple settings, from a long-term care setting, from wherever that may be. When they come into the acute care setting in a hospital, we really reconcile really what they're on and how they're taking it. Now, we add a lot of drugs when they come on and then they're sick. It might be antibiotics, might be anticoagulation, whatever it may be. Upon discharge, we re-reconcile that medication list, which is very important. And we know that best practice is including a pharmacist in this. But unfortunately, you know, it's just the resources aren't there to have that done. So nurses are really kind of doing it. But this little pilot project that I just talked about, that reconciliation then looks at their medicines that they came in on, what they're prescribed, what the doctor intended to continue, up increase in dose, DC it because they're hypotensive, whatever it may be, we reconcile them before they go into the community. So best practice is having a pharmacist involved with that. That doesn't happen in many institutions. So, what are clinical pharmacy services? This is really very important for you guys to understand that this is not a dispensing role that we're talking about. This is really a high-level interaction with as a part of a team, working with the physician, the nurses, and so forth, and we'll talk a lot about that. So, clinical pharmacy services are a clinical services part of a care team, like I said. It's really medication management that is proven to improve health status, improve clinical outcomes, reduce medication-related problems, and reduce overall health care costs, which really is the triple aim. And really what I wanted to highlight again is this is really different from the traditional dispensing role that you would see in a community pharmacy such as a Safeway or Rite Aid. So this is a big slide, guys, and when I sat here and thought about this slide as I was preparing for this talk, clinical pharmacy services include a lot of big words. And when I looked at that, I thought about my role as a pharmacist in a hospital, and we do each and every one of these each day. So when we talk about collaborative drug therapy management protocols, that's really having a physician authorize us to dose a drug, such as warfarin, okay? We also do comprehensive medication management and medication therapy management services, medication reconciliation, what we just talked. So when we go down this list, when we talk about CMM or MTM, medication therapy management, those are not as intense, or we're actually not writing the prescriptions or dosing drugs. We're actually looking at their medications and making recommendations back to the physicians if we're seeing where they could optimize a dose or something. Obviously, co-ed clinics, medication adherence is very important. And then provider education. We provide a tremendous amount of doctor education. In fact, I was in a meeting with the LIMS physicians at Legacy. We employ LIMS physicians, which are legacy internal medicine docs, and they see the patients while they're in the hospital. It's not a surgeon. They're treating their chronic diseases, such as AFib or diabetes. And we went in and sat down and chatted with them about kind of how we can collaborate, and we really work as a team very much on the inpatient side. And they ask us to dose all their warfarin and a lot of their antibiotics and so forth. But we started talking about the new oral anticoagulants, such as rivaroxaban, dabigatran, and apixaban that was just been approved. And when I said those three words to these physicians, they were going, "Whoa, what are you talking about?" You know what I mean?
And don't they watch television?
Exactly, you know, but it was surprising to me how they didn't understand what the impact. And, you know, from a pharmacist's perspective, this has been on my radar for 2 years, right? It's pretty exciting because it might take the place of warfarin. And warfarin is very expensive, and it's a very risky drug. Now, it was just interesting. It's a sidebar.
It's not expensive on its own, but if you add monitoring costs into warfarin, then the drug does get expensive. So it's not nearly as expensive as these newer agents. But there's no monitoring.
Not even in the same universe.
Well,
let me ask about anticoagulation. I mean, I'm a Kaiser member. I've been for 50 years, and I've been on, for AFib, I've been on anticoagulation. It's managed by a couple of nurses on the telephone, I mean, because they have my ongoing medical record. Mm-hmm. They're standing lab orders, which any place I want to show up, and those nurses kind of keep an eye on me. But that seems like a cheaper way to manage it than having a pharmacist involved in a more aggressive way.
Very good point. And you'll see some data where we compared usual care, which was physician, other co-ed clinics that are nurse-run, and then a pharmacist only. It's superior. And so we'll show you some of that data as we move forward. So this is one of my favorite slides. When we talk about changing healthcare and the triple aim of all this, really we're trying to go from a fragmented volume, you know, reimbursement system to a value, and creating value and serving more people using our collective pharmacist capabilities and really our clinical drug expertise. And when we look at that, when we look at the triple aim and trying to create value, changing the patient experience, changing how we produce, you know, provide care, and then really trying to change the payment and reform and provide value, we really think the clinically integrated team is one of the answers, okay? Let me define this team. These teams have been instrumental in an inpatient acute care side in institutions for many years. For example, we round daily on the ICU patients and all our patients with the physician, with the nurse, and with the community health worker, and even a medical health or social worker. What we do is talk about lots of things, but really what our role there as a clinical drug expert is to provide recommendations for the drug. So on the inpatient side, that's pretty settled. What we're trying to do is scale that into an ambulatory care world and really work as a team, as part of the healthcare team, and because we really, their data is out there that when we do this, that outcomes are superior, okay? Patients get to goal, we're all successful, and so when we add that up, we get success.
Is that one of your staff?
I wish that was my son. So this improves patient health and supports primary care. I'm not going to go over this. Obviously, we've talked about how this brings health status under control for those complex patients. This is really important, too. Using these services will help bridge that gap for these 200,000 additional Medicaid lives that are going to come into in 2014. We also know that it reduces medication-related problems, ER visits, and readmissions. And here's another key component that I want the committee to understand, that this really frees primary care providers to dedicate more time to diagnosis and treatment design, and let the pharmacist then treat with the medications and as a team collaborative approach. So let's talk about a little bit what's happening in Oregon around clinical pharmacy service. Like I said, this is happening, okay, in pockets, in very sporadic pockets. And what we're trying to do is scale this. And the scalability of this is difficult because we have some barriers. Number one, we do not have provider status in this country and or in this state, which means that we cannot bill for our services. We're not recognized as providers. Number two, currently, our Board of Pharmacy manages the collaborative drug therapy management. It's really stringent. It's between one physician and one pharmacist. And the language around that is pretty prescriptive. What we're trying to do is broaden that out and have it across maybe a CCO and a group of pharmacists and or really gain provider status so that we could then bill all patients across the commercial, Medicaid, Medicare, and so forth, okay?
So it can be a group of physicians and a pharmacist. So like in my practice site, I collaborate with myself, and then the medical director for my facility signs my collaborative practice agreement, and then that covers the physicians in that facility. But it's very difficult to do outside of an on-site arrangement the way that the rules are written today.
So we're trying to broaden that so we can scale this up to Burns and wherever that may be. So let's talk a little bit about Legacy. And everybody kind of knows who Legacy is. And this data is really coming from one clinic. And just to frame it for you, we've been practicing in this clinic since 1998. Okay, the pharmacist, and he's got one pharmacist, and there's probably about 10 physicians in this. His name's Chris Blem. He's been using these collaborative disease state management protocols since 1998. He's been dosing hypertension, diabetes, COPD, asthma, lipids, congestive heart failure, and smoking cessation, where the physician is actually at the elbow with him and saying, okay, Chris, take this patient because they're at risk. I can't get them to go, okay? The irony of this, though, is out of all 20 legacy primary care clinics, we have pharmacists in two of those. And because of the barriers that I just spoke about, we can't bill, and that our reimbursement is very low because of incident two billing. And the clunkiness of the whole referral process, we haven't been able to scale that. But here's the data. So in 2005, the physician said, "Listen, Chris, why don't you take 77 of our diabetic patients that we have right now and see what you can do with them?" As you can see, the average hemoglobin A1C at start was around 10.7. Just to frame it for you guys, the goal is around 7 to 8. 49% had a greater than 10%. 13 greater than 13%. There's the demographics, and really the population was 30%, 38% uninsured, 48% government, and then 14% commercial. That's a very common patient population for us. So after 2 years in 2007, pretty impressive results with, and really what we feel that the why we're successful in doing this is we can really focus on that disease state at that time. We sit the patients down, we educate them, we titrate their doses, and we really allow them to ask questions and provide feedback. 62% of them had an A1C of less than 8, which was a goal. 30% had an A1C of less than 7. Their current average A1C was 7.7. And obviously, only 4 of 66 had an A1C of over 10. Even more impressive, 73% had reached the LDL goal of less than 100. So any diabetic that's type 2, their low-density lipoprotein needs to be below 100. Their overall average was 87. 49% of them had reached BP goal of less than 130. And then almost 68% of them had reached the BP goal of less than 140 over 90. So this is just one clinic with a busy Emmanuel clinic downtown where they have residents and so forth. And if you ask
the diastolic of 90 is a goal.
Yeah, it's the point, when you have it depends on your risk factors. But yes, that's the national standard for goals. Now, I don't set those. Those are just not by me. But so let's transition into a little bit to the anechoic data, and this is also from Legacy.
You might give me a reference on that. That seems to be much too high.
Just to provide you a reference, the goal based on your risk factors, if you're a smoker, if you have hypertension, if you have other disease, it's 130 over 80, less than that. But initially, if we can get you below 140 over 90, that is considered goal. And you know, depending on what CCO you're in, what ACO you're in, and the literature that you read, that's considered okay. So,
I don't think so.
Depending on risk factor, So we can follow up with that after this. Coag clinic data. very 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 proud of this. When you look at the totality of this, Legacy has over 8 anticoagulation clinics. We have a patient population of about 7,000. I happen to manage the biggest one in the system. And when we look at this, this is major bleeding events per 100 patient years. On the vertical axis, that's the patient years and the number of events. Down below is LHS, stands for Legacy Health System. Like I said before, the usual care is defined as just a physician in a primary care clinic. The other ACCs are nurse and or a combination of pharmacist-run anticoagulation clinics. As you can see, we were superior in this instance, and this is a year's data. Even more impressive, you guys, is the thromboembolic events that we have avoided. Really, our goal of therapy is to keep these patients safe and in an effective range of between 2 and 3 in an INR. When you look at the usual care, it's 11.8 events per 100 patient years. Other coag clinics is 3.3, and Legacy was 1.6. And that accounted for almost a cost avoidance of $5.2 million for those 7,000 patients, which was pretty impressive.
Is that a net or gross?
That is a net when
that
we back out.
That includes your
Our cost. Services, yep, cost of usual care and all that. So, yep. So I'm going to hand it over to Stacy so she can speak. Do you want to just look
at it? Oh, no, it's okay.
I'm sorry, is that the cost estimate on here?
The estimate is on my notes. I can get that to you. And it actually goes over kind of how many bleed or thromboembolic events we avoided. It was 281 per 100 patient years. And then it breaks down how we came up with that figure. If you do have a stroke or a DVT or an MI, it's about $17,000 per admit. That hospitalization, when we avoid that, we back those costs out, and that's how we come up with that figure.
And the usual care data is in your
usual care system? Is just a physician in a normal primary care clinic without a pharmacist.
Not your population. You didn't randomize those in your population.
We just took usual care from the national database sources from many published studies.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to transition just a little bit. So the services Corey described are services that we offer in our facility as well. So again, we are an FQHC. We have 4 locations, and we actually just brought on our 3rd clinical pharmacist. So we've approached expansion slightly differently. Our pharmacists are half-time with the university and then spend the other half of the time providing clinical services at our 4 locations. We have very similar collaborative practice agreements to what Corey described, with the addition of depression or major depressive disorder, so we do work some with our psychiatrists. We also sit on our facility is a Tier 3 patient-centered primary care home, so we operate as part of the team. Pharmacists actually got us to that Tier 3 status, so we're kind of proud of that. We don't have an on-site pharmacy in any of our facilities, so the only services we provide are clinical services. And we struggled really with how much detail to give you guys about the way we deliver services. So one example we have is, so in my clinic, all newly diagnosed diabetics see their primary care provider for a diagnosis, and then they're handed off to the pharmacist for decisions on treatment and management. So we have kind of a flow sheet that we can share for you if that's of interest to the committee. But in our facility, we've decided that that's the best use of resources. So the primary care provider provides the diagnosis, then hands them to the pharmacist for treatment decisions. So we decide which medications they're going to be on. We titrate their doses. We order follow-up lab tests where appropriate. We might make referrals to other sources, so maybe diabetes education classes, a dietitian, a case manager, a social worker if that's appropriate, a health navigator. And so it really is, you know, we're part of that program to help us manage our diabetics. One of the other things that we've done in our facility is look at, so I'm going to present some information that's just a slightly different take on pharmacists. So I think that improving clinical outcomes, pharmacists have been shown time and time again to improve clinical outcomes. We can also add value to the health system by allowing other providers to meet some of their goals as well. So one of the projects that we recently concluded was a project to try and help our psychiatrists meet their meaningful use standards. So meaningful use allows them to maximize reimbursement for their services. Psychiatrists in our facility don't do any, they don't have anything to do with the physical health of the patient. So they operate solely as psychiatric providers. But under meaningful use, they need to gather some data in order to meet that criteria. So they need to have vitals. They need to have appropriate lab tests ordered. Someone needs to have updated the patient's allergies. They need to have reconciled all of their medications. And so we partnered with our psychiatrists to try and see whether or not adding pharmacists into that service allowed them to meet their meaningful use guidelines. And so that's what the data is that you've got there in front of you. We actually have increased these numbers. This is an ongoing project because it increased their rates so much that they decided to keep sending us patients. And so I think it'll continue to be a service that we offer in our facility. Again, we also can bring value in by freeing up provider time for other functions such as diagnosis. And then I guess the final value that we add, at least in our facility, is around the patient-centered primary care home status. So prior to having clinical pharmacists, the facility was only able to, you know, start the process or achieve that tier one status. But with the expansion of clinical pharmacists to all of our facilities, we're able to reach the tier three status, which is the highest status or highest level of PCPCH in Oregon.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, we are happy about that.
Do you want to speak a little bit to the...
Yeah, so we have some information. We have another member that kind of works on some of this stuff with us who was not able to be here today but represents a payer source. So Pacific Source Health Plans has some different data, and again, we try to bring just a slightly different perspective for the three sources of information. So they contract with local pharmacists in primarily community settings to provide medication therapy management to Medicare Part D members. So if you recall, part of the Medicare Modernization Act in 2006 was to expand pharmacist services so that all Medicare Part D plans have to offer medication therapy management to high-risk folks. So the definition of high-risk varies from plan to plan, but it usually is a certain number of chronic conditions, certain number of medications, and a certain drug spend per year. And so the results that they saw for the 2011-2012 was improved patient satisfaction, which weren't surprised about. There were about a little over 647 patients that they saw. There were 55 different pharmacies that were participating. Most of them were pharmacists who were in more traditional dispensing roles in community pharmacies, but then did this in addition to that role. They did have 6 non-dispensing consultant pharmacists participate in this project as well. And they found 1,000 patients avoided medication-related problems due to this service. And they estimated that their return on investment was about $7 for every dollar spent, and that their total savings was in excess of $500,000. So that's just in the very small pilot project with really not that many encounters when we look at all the potential patients that could be seen by a pharmacist.
Great. I'm going to go over this really high level. This is more from a global perspective, but the power of this is when we talk about over 15,000 patients, and this was a multi-state study that it showed that when you provide comprehensive medication management, this was presented by a physician actually at a national conference, and really I just want to go really quick just to kind of get to the ROI and get through this. The net savings, and you guys have it in front of you, the net savings of providing these services is around $6 million when we back out the cost of doing the services. That ROI was really, you know, soft at around 3-1. The other important aspect of this is that this study showed that that comprehensive medication management has a profound effect on the provider workforce shortage. And when they looked at this, over 35,000 of those 14,000 patients, 35,000 provider visits were avoided. So that means that frees up space for physicians to see patients in a different aspect. And that's really what we wanted to highlight here. So where are we going with the with this service in the future? So today, we are working as this committee, and we're part of this committee to really to increase our voice and really understand what we're trying to accomplish. What we've accomplished to date is we've got Bruce Goldberg's support, and he wrote a letter on our behalf and sent it to all CCOs in January. We also presented to the Oregon Health Plan Quality, the medical director meeting, and it was well received. The physicians really liked this data, and really we're trying to have great questions on how we can scale this and introduce it. We're also working with each CCO, one-on-one meetings with them, and try to how to incorporate that, because when we really talk about these services to the executives of CCOs, even though they may be physicians, they don't understand what we're talking about when we talk about clinical pharmacy services. And so that's really our charge, is to educate. And then also we're developing a story of what we're trying to do. And this is unprecedented in the state. We've got the Board of Pharmacy approval to send an email to all pharmacists across the state. We're going to survey them in Brookings and Burns and wherever it may be about what their services they're providing. If it's even a telephonic service to a rural patient and checking in on them, or if it's managing their anticoagulation through a phone or in person, or whatever clinical pharmacy service they're doing, we're gonna try to gather that data. And really that's a twofold thing. We're gonna make sure we can connect these pharmacy services throughout the state, but then we really wanna share and collaborate best practice across all our patient population, including the CCOs. So what also we're doing is, as I've already stated, that we're really doing this in health systems and FQHCs, but really we don't have any mechanism to reimburse. So really at a hospital level, we are a cost center. And for an administrator or a CEO or a CFO, it's a barrier that we have, okay? And it's because we don't have provider status. We also, we're forging new partnerships, and we're trying to expand and standardization of all these clinical pharmacies. Our goal as this committee and our team is really to have look at the best practice for diabetes, and Representative Chairman Greenlee, if the blood pressure goal is now 130 over systolic of less than 90, we really want to be able to transpire that to all physicians and pharmacists across the state or even across the country in a unified manner, so that we're all achieving the same goals, right? So clinical pharmacy services, really what we're happening nationally. There's all the national pharmacy associations are working together to try to achieve provider status. And it's in the Social Security Act. And obviously, we always joke about it. It will be an act of Congress if we can get that passed. However, other states, including Washington and California, are adopting legislation around provider status so that at least the pharmacist in that state can provide care and bill commercial and or Medicare and Medicaid plans for reimbursement.
I do need to break in, but yeah. If there's anything we're trying to do in this committee, it's to convert revenue centers to cost centers. And I think the notion that we would end up with another fee-for-service payment model would have tough sledding here. Seems to me when we capitate a CCO, they ought to be able to make a determination of what's the appropriate cost centers to use and figure out how to maximize their ability to do what they want with the capitation they get, rather than creating another fee-for-service revenue center. Strikes me.
Completely understand, and in all aspects, really, we're only talking about 600,000 lives under capitation. Really, the other 1.5 million patient
population. Oh, we're talking about moving that to nearly a million lives, in fact.
Right, that's exactly right. But really, in an ACO, which is still a fee-for-service model, and so is the commercial side. And for us to integrate and try to balance, I'm not saying that we're trying to make money. It's just we just need to be able to be recognized to provide. So it really loosens the barrier. It's just one of the barriers. Now, we're going to continue to forge forward. And in the CCO world, we know that it's capitated.
Well, or in the primary care home model. The notion you need to be able to decide how to spend your money in an adequate way. And we don't want the purpose of primary care homes to be finding revenue maximization. We want rather them to be doing productivity maximization rather than revenue maximization.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the slides we had before kind of supports that. So if you have pharmacists and pharmacists are offering services, you absolutely see increased prior
that's the argument.
Productivity.
And it seems to me that's the appropriate argument.
Absolutely.
So these are just some other high-level things that we can read and we can go over about what's happening nationally and in the sectors. So where are we going looking forward? We, for sustainability, and like we've talked about it, we're looking, to maybe have some verbiage around provider status. And then House Bill 3466, which was introduced late in the session, and we'll talk about that as we move through this. We also want to generate a financially stable model in a capitated world.
Encourage you all to ask questions, I say.
Absolutely. In a capitated world, we understand as more goals as CCOs and or ACOs, which there's none of in the state of Oregon yet, as they reach their goals, reimbursement or shared savings may come about that. And so that's what we're trying to accomplish, is really the triple aim. We also want to become a service that's sought after for patients. If you talk to Stacy and look at her and poll her patients, and if you look at the patients that come to our clinic, they really value the relationship that they have with the pharmacist, because it's just a little bit different than what they have with their physician, and really that's our goal. So the future, we want to achieve provider status if we can, and support different payment models, and may it be fee-for-service and/or capitation. We want to make sure that all the pharmacists in the state are working at the top of their license. We really want to become part of this medical home integration. And how that looks, we know that this team concept that I showed you in that graphic, we know the value of that is very valued in the setting of Chris Blem, the data that I showed you, and it's we just really want to be able to scale that up. And then we want to standardize these services across the state. So like I said, if there's a new protocol or a new drug developed that improves outcomes, we want to be able to help educate the physicians in the community about that. So let's talk about House Bill 3466 a little bit. We really just wanted to...
ask a question first.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see you talking about the kind of older clinical models, which talks about pharmacy and therapeutics committees and dealing with cost-effective delivery of services. I mean, the tradition has always been to let's make sure we go to the most expensive drug we can go, because the drug companies like that, rather than trying to deal with it. I mean, particularly, say with the real kind of question you're talking about, anticoagulation, as an example.
Right.
It seems to me it's going to be a while before those high price models with 2.5 minutes of warnings on television become a better deal than morphine. I mean, unless you don't mind, it increases such a cancer and increases it to death, and an erection more than 4 hours, so that may be a different one. It seems to me we ought to be very slow in going to those, but that's not one of the clinical, you guys have real clinical expertise in that area more than anybody has.
I think that we kind of just figure that the role of pharmacists on P&T committees is
You take that as a given.
Yeah, that's kind of a given. Okay. So that, I think, will continue as... entities have to make decisions about what kinds of drugs they're going to use. I think pharmacists will be involved in those conversations going forward. We're really looking at the more direct care to patient.
So when we talk, any other questions? This is our last slide here, so we'll get through this. So we introduced, like I said, this concept was really just to be able to scale these services up and be recognized at the state level in the state of Oregon, allowing pharmacists to modify or change under these protocols, and really that's what it's about. It's really trying to expand all our services across all patient populations, obviously not just CCOs or Medicaid and Medicare. And then, obviously we're all trying to reach the triple aim and improve the patient and the health of a population. And really for us to be successful moving forward, we really need to do that across our entire patient population, myself included. So that's really what that bill was for. We want a work session maybe this in the off season, maybe going into the next legislative year. So do you have anything to add to that? Okay.
Jim, do you have some comments?
No, I just, I think we've been down this road before. I mean, it's an opportunity to utilize a segment of healthcare that we have underutilized. And we're talking about community health providers in a different way. And there's a lot of the gaps we have to address that I think this is the way to do it. And the big areas I've been involved in, asthma management, that kind of thing, we're doing a lousy job nationally. We've been doing a lousy job since the 1970s. And yet this is an area that we could bring expertise in, because largely it is lifestyle and medication management to get the results we want and lower hospitalizations. But physicians have not had the time with their patient loads to put into this population. And I think if we look at diabetes and a number of these other things, if we can move from the diagnostic side to a management side with a team approach, get more of the community level pharmacy people involved in those day-to-day monitorings, interactions, obviously with a connection to the physician, but we can reduce the cost, increase the participation rate, and really hugely impact the success. Study after study that shows it's done, but we just don't implement them.
I have to admit, I had an article just over 50 years ago in the American Journal of Pharmacy Education arguing for these kind of models. So
yeah.
This isn't the first time I've heard about them.
My concern right now is that as we move everything forward, we're going to hire a bunch of community health care people, which we have not specified who or what they are yet. We're going to put a lot of money into some bells and whistles, and we're going to completely bypass something that we already have in place that we can tweak, add to the team, and make it work. And I'm not sure we need a lot of these other kinds of people we're talking about if we utilize people we already have in a different kind of team framework. It doesn't denigrate what the physician does. It's still an important element.
Mm-hmm.
It just spreads out the day-to-day management and monitoring. And you probably can't get to see your physician every day anyway if you needed to, but you could see your pharmacist every day if you were in trouble.
That's the last thing I'd want.
Yeah, so it's a matter of design.
Do you think having a fee-for-service payment authorization for them is the or
I don't know what we're going to do with payment. The bottom line is we're going to do more with less money. I'm not sure fee-for-service is the direction, but we have to deliver a better quality of product, better management for less money.
More cost.
I mean, it seems to me any CCO or looking at such say, yeah.
Well, I think that they are. Sorry.
Lively?
Well, and that was kind of, I appreciate this conversation, because part of mine was thinking, so how are we going to get there? Mm-hmm. Part when you talk about spending the money to do on people who are available versus creating more, that makes some sense from that standpoint. But the issue is always this transition. I can appreciate and understand, quote, we're going to save money. But until we save money, in many cases, we've got to spend more money. Or as you're suggesting, you can't provide the services for free. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody's got to pay for that. And so, well, I think we may all agree, and I think since it's still unclear to me, how we do that at the same time we're trying to save money, because I agree, I think this makes a lot of sense, the expertise. The other question I have, so are there enough pharmacists? So if we make this, I mean, is there enough, or are we going to be in the same position we are with doctors and others? We still have a shortage of people available to do it.
I think we have a shortage no matter what.
Regardless.
Nurses, doctors, pharmacists, dentists, you name it.
It's always.
Where we're going, we're going to have a shortage. But on the money side,
well, we need the pharmacy assistants to work at the top of there.
Right. Everybody has to scale up.
Everybody has to be doing, working at the top of their license in order for healthcare to work.
On the asthma side, for years and years, the studies have shown the inordinately high costs of asthma care has been in lack of asthma care, resulting in repeated hospitalization.
Sure.
You get these people under good management, you immediately get the money back from the hospital, which they're not going to be excited about, but that's huge volumes of money spent in for short-term bursts in lieu of spending more moderate amounts of money for long-term management. And I think the transition can come fairly quickly once we make a decision we're going to start doing some of these disease states and move the emphasis. And it's going to take patient buy-in too.
So I can tell you that, so just with one patient this year, I've already paid my salary for the rest of the year. So he was in the hospital 7 times over 2 months. I started seeing him every week. He was drinking, his diabetes was out of control. I mean, so he had a whole slew of things. He comes and sees me every week. We have a standing 9:30 Friday morning appointment. He hasn't been back in the hospital since. And so just in the amount of time, you know, if we factored in all of those hospitalizations, I've already paid my salary. I could probably pay our other two pharmacists' salaries simply with one patient, and, you know, and that's what I spend 2 days a week doing.
Are you going to take the rest of the year off? Huh?
No rest of the year off. But
in terms of a Lively's point, I remember sitting in management meetings with Kaiser in budget explanations, and the information services people would come in and say, if you give us $1 million, we have this great thing that 4 years from now we'll start delivering.
Right.
$1 million a year in savings. It'll pay for itself year after year. So the CEO would look to the pharmacy manager and say, well, would you pick up half of that $1 million out of your budget this year, and we'll put the other half in? And the answer was, hell no, I don't have enough money in my budget now to do what you want me to do.
Right.
And furthermore, I don't really believe it'll save $1 million. They've told us that story before. But even if I did, I mean, what am I going to do? I have to fill these prescriptions. I can't not fill them. And that really is the problem. It's that.
That's everybody working to the top of their license. One of the
shortcomings.
We have about one more minute before we
in the whole system is determining how to get patient buy-in. And a lot of this stuff in chronic disease management is not different than AA or Weight Watchers. It requires a patient to change their schedule and their outlook to do something about their problem other than receive services.
But the secret is to make it easier for them to do what you want them to do.
But it's
not. I mean, that anticoagulation, it's clearly that way.
Yeah.
If I'm not willing to talk to the nurse when she wants me to do something, well, I'm going to have to go in and see a doctor one of these days, which I sure as hell don't want to do.
But I've done this with asthma, and I can tell you in as little as 3 or 4 weeks of program, once-a-week meetings, you can't get the people out of the program because you increase the quality of their life so dramatically, so quickly, they suddenly say, this is what I'd rather be doing.
Right.
Yeah. But it requires them to participate on a different level than just going to the hospital or getting a doctor's appointment a week and a half from now or whatever they've been doing that hasn't been working. Their quality of life is in the toilet and whatnot. But we can, once we get that patient buy-in, the whole thing starts to come together. And we haven't asked for that yet.
Thank you guys very much for coming. We have to be on the floor. We thought we'd have more time.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You did a great job.
We'll continue this discussion.
I hope you think I hassled you too much.
No.
I will close the information hearing. This is a topic we will be back on a continuous basis. And we are adjourned. Next Friday.